Welcome back, everybody, to our Shimshon share. What we're going to be doing this evening is we're actually going to start the Psukim dealing with Shimshon himself. We're going to be just starting afresh, anew. We're going to learn a little bit about his life and try to get a sense of him. He's a little bit of a complex character, as the Shoftim are at the end section of Shoftim. We're beginning Shoftim Perek Yod Dalet. That's going to be found in the booklets that we have in front of us is page 3. So the very top, the very beginning, it's all a whole new start of everything we've been doing up to now. So even if you haven't had the background up to now, we're all on the same page. The story itself speaks for itself. This is really a edge of the seat kind of story. It really is dramatic to the point of it's very hard to stop. So we're going to try to get as much as we can in. So the we're told the following. Nach tells us that Vayeret Shimshon Timnasa Vayar Isha B'Timnasa Mibnas Plishtim. So Shimshon goes down to Timnasa and he sees this woman from among the Philistines. Okay, let's just think back for a moment over here. Like, you know, if your scan and alarm sensors were on, and like you had an alarm every time a word appeared in Tanakh. So the word that's interesting to notice over here is where else in Tanakh does the word Timnasa ring a bell? Where else in Tanakh? Okay, so there happens to be Timnasa. This is tucked away early on in Sefer Bereishis, all the way at the beginning, is that the episode of Yehuda, when he goes from his brothers, is to be found where he goes to shear his sheep in Timnasa as well. Very interesting over here. Interestingly enough, the beginning of the story, let's just contextualize that for a moment. By Yehuda, what happens? Yehuda is the person who should have taken responsibility for saving Yosef. He doesn't take responsibility to the fullest extent. He says, let's sell him. And afterwards, he sees the terrible plight his father's in. His father's inconsolable to the situation. So at that point in time, it says, Vayered Yehuda, and that Yehuda descends from among his brothers, and he goes to live in this place, and he marries this woman from Adullam, and he has children. That is a whole Yerida. That is a descent. Yehuda's, we'll call it his falling foul of his status in among the brothers. And in and amongst that story, there's not only just the Vayera that he descends. There's he goes to shear his sheep in Timnasa, and that's when he meets. He meets the woman who he doesn't know is actually Tamar on the way of the road. It is intriguing that here we have Shimshon going to the same place Yehuda went. Also, to notice a woman who is unknown and certainly at this point is not of the Jewish faith. It's interesting just to put that in context, to think about what this is the harmony of the melody of the story over here is the Yehuda episode. Just without even going any further, we don't even need to read the Mephoreshim right now. Just to notice this very strange parallel. So that's how he starts. He sees this woman. We don't know anything. We don't know about his reactions. We just know that he sees her. So what does he do? We continue. Pasuk Beis. Vayal, vayal, he ascends. Vayaged le'aviv ulehimoy. Vayomer isha ra'isi mitimnasa miblosh mpilishtim. Va'ato kechu asa li'li isha. So he ascends and he tells his parents. And he says, I've seen this daughter of the Philistines. Please, can you take her for me? And what's interesting over here is just if you want to use the actual idea of up and down, going up and down, why would that make sense geographically? Just besides for let's call it the spiritual ups and downs in his life. Why is ups and downs make a lot of sense? Where is he living? Where is she living? She is of what race or what nation? She's a Philistines. Where do the Philistines live?
On the coast.
They live on the coastal plain. So let's say, you know, for those of you who've done this recently, you're in Jerusalem, in the hills of Jerusalem, which is the hills, and you're going down to Ashdod or to Tel Aviv or wherever else it is. It's always a descent because you're moving from the Hare Yehuda, from the Yehuda and Shomron, you're going down towards the Shvela, right? So just geographically, it makes a lot of sense that he's now going back up to his parents. But we have to think that it also might not just be geographical, but it might be the contours of his state, right? They're on the high grounds, so to speak, spiritually, and he's had this lowering. Fine, fantastic. He goes back now. Let's just read the next passage and then consider one thing over here. He says the father responds. His parents say, and as any good Jewish parents would say in this situation, they would say, Isha ki ata alech lakach zisha mipnei shtem arelim. And they say, Bubala. You know, are there any good Jewish girls? Right? Meaning, you had to find a Philistine girl. That's the response his parents have. And he says, Vayomer Shimshon el Aviv oso kachli ki hi yashra be'enai. He says, look, she is the one who's straightened my eyes. He's found his love, and he wants to marry her. This is all quite shocking, because all we've known about Shimshon is that he was born as a special type of person. He's a Nazarite from utero, and we know that the Ruach Hashem is in front of him, maybe as a bell or in some form or fashion. He's being led by God. That's all we know. And then the first thing we know about him is his episode with meeting Miss Perfect, and Miss Perfect is not a Jewish woman. So a very difficult to understand over here. There's a few things we need to take note of. First of all, is she Jewish? Is this young lady Jewish?
No, me plishtim.
Right. So we're told that she's Philistine, but
we don't know because it's uncircumcised plishtim. Okay. So the man.
Right. In general, the Philistines are called uncircumcised because that was their general practice. That was like sort of like that was like the way that the Israelites would denote the Philistines in the most derogatory way would be these uncircumcised Philistines, and that like sort of that was the derogatory way of describing them because they were so couth. Right, but let's think about this for a second. He's going to marry her. What's the word he uses to describe marriage over here? Is kach. Do you notice that he uses that in his request in both pasuk beis and pasuk gimel? Right, he says kachu asali, and he says kachli. He responds again. It happens to be that the word kicha or vayikach in the Torah refers to specifically marriage. It's the halachic contract of marriage. In fact, there is early on in the Torah, we learn this in a very fascinating source, that kicha, it means the notion of the contract of marriage, and there's a plethora of halachas which are learned out of this in Meseches Kiddushin as to what this contract means. It happens to be that Kiddushin don't work when it comes to a Jew marrying a non-Jewess, right? Meaning the halachic concept of likuchin, of marriage, doesn't actually work with a non-Jewish woman. So what is he saying over here? What is he essentially saying? Understands the Ralbag, understands the Radak. What's he saying?
He's saying
make her Jewish in order to marry her, really. Meaning he really wants a marriage. He doesn't just want a relationship. He wants a marriage, which is important to us because it helps us understand a little bit over here. And the Mefarshim across the board take note of this word as being significant, that he's not just trying to have a fling over here, which is why he's coming back to his parents. Right? Meaning, he seems to be taking as difficult as it is to understand for them and for us, but at the same time, he still has intent of a real marriage over here. Now, unfortunately, there's a breakdown in the conversation, as you can notice. Notice what's happened over here in this conversation. Something very tragic has happened. Look very carefully. Who's in this conversation from beginning to end in these two psukim, Beis to Gimel? He comes back and he talks to whom?
His parents.
And who responds?
Never talks to her.
He doesn't talk to her. So she's not in the picture yet. Right. She's going to be in the picture, and unfortunately, she's not the greatest of character. But he talks to his parents. Who responds?
His parents
respond. They say, can't you find another woman? And who does he respond to?
His father.
What happened there? Right? You see what happened? Suddenly, mother is not in the picture anymore. Mother is not in the picture anymore, which is very interesting over here. Something in the conversation has changed.
Vayomer lo, it doesn't say Vayomer lo.
Okay, interesting. It could also be that they're so intensely focused on this that it becomes, you know, they don't see. There's no way they can see otherwise. I do hear your point, though. That does that, but he has to
talk to his father because his father is the one that is going to do the action. It's not the mother who is doing the
action. Okay, so it might be his father who's going to be in charge of the legal or financial side
so
of things,
he has
right?
To
yeah,
talk to her.
It might be that. On the other hand, there could also be something very tragic. The Lev Aaron, who's one of the commentaries that the Man Noez indicates, he has an incredible, you know, array of later Achronim on Nach, and he says that perhaps he realizes, if you take the context of what's happened over here, who's the person who the angel appeared to? Who's the person who had to change her entire course of life to have this special child? And to bring up this special child was Eshes Manoach, his mother. His mother was the one who put in all this sweat, blood, and tears, literally. And he realized that she would not be able to understand this. This is something that his insistence would not be something that she could fathom. And tragically, he has to explain it only to his father because she's beyond the comprehension of what he's trying to do. Which is a very sad point over here, you see, in this conversation over here, which is a suggestion over here, because you see they're being omitted. Dina's point still remains well taken, which is that his father is going to be the person who is asking to perform the actions, which is all the finance necessary behind it. So here we have the request, and now he's about to go down. So he's insistent, and we continue. Apparently, they both are part of this continued story in Pasuk Dalet. But his parents did not know that it was from God. Because he is seeking, Tana, how do they translate it over here? They say in the translation,
an occasion,
right? So that he's looking for an occasion. So, Tana, it perhaps means more readily a negative claim. We're going to see in a moment what this means. And at that time, the Philistines were ruling Israel. So over here, exactly, a reason, something to hang your coat on in a certain way. And Rashi understands that what he's trying to do over here, as we're going to see, is he's looking for something that he can blame them for. He's looking for something that he can blame the Philistines for. Why does he need to do it this way? What's the end of the pasuk? Because they're the ruling class. Meaning he can't start going around and doing terrorist activity because he'll get killed. So what does he need to do? He needs to find a way of creating a pretext, a to'ana, for any activity that he's going to do. Okay, so that's the way that Rashi understands, and we're going to see how this plays itself out. What is most fascinating over here is that what his parents not realize? What's the lack of realization that they have in this emotional drama over here is that it's from?
Hashem.
From God. So interesting. In fact, the Gemara goes so far as to say, the Gemara in Moed Katan on Daf Yud Ches on Obeis actually says that we see that there are things which are Shiduchim, that the idea of finding one's soulmate is from God, and the Torah goes on to prove it, or the Gemara goes on to prove it from Torah, from Nevi'im, and from Ksuvim. And the case that it brings from Nevi'im is our case. Isn't that remarkable? Meaning, how do you know that God is orchestrating the whole idea of relationships? Is because we see one of the cases that the case in point is over here, is that God orchestrated the relationship of Shimshon and his wife, his unnamed wife. Now, that's something to think about. Meaning, over here, it doesn't sound like this is very godly right now. He is assimilating, or she is at the best. At best, she's converting, but it sounds like it's on her terms, we're going to see in just a few minutes. This is very strange. One would have to wonder what the Me Hashem is, what the godly plan is over here. Is it that she is really his destined betrothed? Or is it maybe that the whole grand scheme of things is Me Hashem as well? We have to question how much of this is him choosing, him actively realizing this is right, or is a God saying, in your actions, I will find what's right. Okay, that's what we have to keep in the back of our minds over here, is how much is Shimshon the tool, the active tool, or the reactive tool in the hand of God. Okay, that's what we have to think as we're doing this. Okay?
Is there another way of looking at it? Because it says here that his parents did not know. But he, not that he knew, but he was looking for a reason, meaning that maybe he knew what his shlichut was, but his parents did not know. So even though we don't hear that there is any contact between Shimshon and Hashem, maybe from this pasuk we can learn that he really did know what his mission was.
Okay, great. I think that's what Rashi is really getting at, is that Shimshon is more keyed into what's going on over here than anybody else. He's got this particular mission, which is so personal that his own parents don't even realize, which is a little bit of the tragedy of this character, Shimshon, because he's living a double life then, right? What I'd like to do is expand upon that theme as we get a little more of the picture of his life, exactly what Dina was suggesting. So this over here begins the point where Shimshon becomes much more a silo. He's acting independent of his parents over here. They're accompanying him, but they're not necessarily realizing what's going on over here. Very, very interesting breakaway that's happening, as Dina's pointing out. We continue. Now, if you're watching very carefully, let's count the Vayereds here, okay? Let's count how many times it describes his descent. Okay, we already had it in the first pasuk, pasuk Aleph. And now again, we have it the second time in pasuk Hey. Vayered Shimshon vavivimoy. Shimshon and his father and his mother descended to Timnasa. Vayavo ad karme Timnasa vihina kfir arios sho egli krasoi. And by the vineyards of Timnasa, there is this young lion, these young lions who are approaching him or roaring at his approach. Vatitzlach alav ruach Hashem. And the Spirit of God has succeeded on him. He rips it apart like you'd rip apart the goat. Now that's also quite pretty incredible. Okay, but I mean the point is that not a predator. He doesn't tell his parents what he did. Again, interestingly enough, he's breaking away. Now, what's the most important question we need to ask right over here is he was with them. And then the lion was attacking or roaring to attack him, right? You see, there's this split happens in the middle pasuk. Hey, right? They are coming to the Karame Timnasa, and then the Arya is attacking him. And by the way, when a lion attacks you, now not from personal experience, but even though I do hail from South Africa. There are no jungles in South Africa. Those are in India or in Central Africa. But this cannot have been a quiet affair. Right, so if he's not telling them, that means to say he's obviously some distance from them to the degree that they can't and they wouldn't have guessed what had happened. So what happens? Something happened. They obviously split paths. So what the Mepharshim was struggling with over here is the obvious fact that they're in very different places, but they were together for just a moment ago. Yeah. So what was going on over here? That's what the Mepharshim was struggling with earlier and later in the Mepharshim.
He's at a caravan.
Oh, he's at a vineyard. So fantastic. Oh. So here's an interesting point. So the Mamno Ayes says that the Mamno Ayes suggests something really interesting. And that is that remember that Shimshon is a Nazarite. So therefore, what's happening over here is that he's about to approach the vineyards of Timnasa, which obviously surround the city, because that's where they plant. So what does he do? He has to go a different way. He has to go take the long route round. His parents go straight through the middle. He goes round the side. And it is at that point that he meets us. Now, interestingly enough, if you just consider this in the bigger picture for a moment, here you have the Nazarite who's... He's not drinking wine. He's not eating grapes. He's not even entering the vineyard, but he's going to marry a Philistine woman. Okay, just to appreciate the dramatic irony of the situation over here that you have playing itself out. But perhaps there's another way of looking at this. And then the Mamno Ayes suggests another idea, which is that he quotes the Yerushalmi that says that his parents pointed to him and said, you know, if you look at these vineyards very carefully, you'll know that these are grafted grapes. Right, people, the farmers over here in the valley would take different fruits and combine them to grow them to get a finer product. And they were pointing to these vineyards because they were trying to impress upon him that we don't do that. Meaning we don't. What was that?
Invagev.
Well, that's if it's something else, right? If you're grafting something else, there is an isser of kilayim. Right, and certainly with grapes, to grow grapes and another actual vegetation together is an isser. And they were trying to, in a metaphoric sense, show him that this is really what you're doing. Right, you're mixing your pure heritage with somebody else from the outside. Be very, very careful. And so what happens? Well, what was his response in this scenario? The Mamno Ayes suggests that his response was to walk away. I mean, he didn't want to have to face that. He didn't want to have to face that message. So why is he by himself? He's by himself because he specifically wanted to avoid the message which those vines were presenting to him. There's just interesting over here. And so why is there separation? There's a separation in discord rather than a separation in piety, as the first suggestion would have possibly afforded us. See, this seems to be a very trivial detail. It might be have metaphoric. It might be metaphorically significant. It seems to be a trivial detail, but ladies, this is not a trivial detail, as we will see as the story continues. Vayered, we continue in Pasuk Zion. Again, this is our word again. Vayered, Vayedaber La'isha. Now, this Vayered clearly is not geographic, right? Because he is already down there. He's already come to the coastal plain. So this Vayered is most clearly an indication that Shimshon is on a downward moral slope. And he says, "Vayadaber la'isha, vatishar be'enei Shimshon." He spoke to the woman, and she finds favor in his eyes. It's interesting that she finds favor now, because you think if you're so strongly, intensely in love with her, you know that should have happened beforehand. I wonder about that over here. "Vayoshav miyamim lakachto vayasar liros es maperes aryeh v'hinei adas tvorim begvias aryeh udvash." So he returns after days, to marry her. So it seems that over here there's a period, as there was common in those days, a period before marriage. You wouldn't just marry a person. There'd be, you know, the arrangements that were made beforehand, and then there's a while, perhaps even a year, in which you are betrothed and the marriage would take place later on. So over here it sounds like he's taken a break, meaning they agree upon this marriage, but then he returns, which is interesting because this is not, as much as some people would like to paint this as, you know, this hedonistic, you know, uncontrollable, you know, lusting person, it's not that simple. You see over here that whatever his ideas were, this is not just about, you know, him and his lust. He's waiting however long it is in order to marry her, right? He's very dedicatedly waiting for this young lady. And when he returns, there's obviously enough time that in the carcass of his lion has grown a beehive, and there's bees and honey now flying out of the carcass or the remains of this lion, which is interesting. Why? What is the idea over here? What is the message or the image that it could be gained from this idea of these bees coming out of the arye, of the lion? Right, the bees represent, on the one hand, they're something really sweet. On the other, we're going to see is emotional, but at the same time, they also have a sting. You know, there's something interesting over here about the sweetness, but the sting coming out of the predator. Right, there's the dead predator, and out of the dead predator, sweetness coming out. You could apply this, the Meforshim, try applying this in different ways. Maybe it's referring to the person who he is about to get married to. She seems very sweet, but there's a sting to her. We're going to see the women in his life are going to have that other edge to them, as sweet as they seem. It also might be, if you flip it on its side, maybe the carcass of the lion is the Philistine power, but out of that power can come a small bee, which can wield much more power because it's a dead carcass. There's lots of ways you can push this in any direction over here, and the Mephoroshim struggle to sort of identify, but it's interesting that there's something obviously going on over here in this picture, and he's going to use this. He's going to use this message, as you were saying, in just a moment. So we carry on. Pasuk Tes, Vayirdehu el Kapov. What's the word? What's that word there? You know, so again, comes from the source of Yered, but he brings out all the combs into his hand. Vayelech halach v'achal, and as he walks, he eats. Vayelech el aviv ve'el imoy, vayiten lahem vayachelu v'lo yigid lahem kim gviyas ariyei v'rada hadvash. So he takes this honey and the combs and he gives it to them, and he presents it to them just as a gift. Once again, he doesn't tell them, for whatever reason, he doesn't tell them that where the honey comes from. This is the second time he's not telling them about it. And now, once again, our words. You see, this is clearly the theme of this section over here. Is in Pasuk Yud, Vayered Avihu El Yesha. His father descends to the woman. Vayas Sham Shimshon Mishteh Kichen Yasu Abachurim. And they make a feast, a tremendous feast, because that's the way people would do it in such days. What's interesting over here is this is the first time that our verb Vayered is applied not to Shimshon, but to whom? But to his father. To his father. It's interesting. Has something happened? Has his father somehow bought into what he is presenting here? One would wonder what's happened to his father, that his father's in the same picture. Now his father's also descending. in the same vein.
Both of them were descending, his father and his mother, in the beginning. They were
correct. And now, right. Now it sounds like it's his father specifically, but the Malbim points out that this specific descent is for practical purposes. Mm-hmm. The father is doing all the arrangements. That's why he's making the feast, which is obviously a big part of the wedding, would be who's paying for. In those days, there weren't bands and there weren't flowers, but whatever the feast would be is obviously a big part of the marriage, and his father is going to settle that. So now the marriage is underway. Vayihi in pasuk yud aleph. Kiras amasa vayichu shloshim mereim vayihu ito. They see him. They bring 30 friends. You can imagine this must be quite the party. Yud beis vayomer lahem Shimshon. Achuda lachem chida. I am going to spin you a riddle. Im aged tagidu asali shiva simei mishter umetzasem venasati lachem shloshim sidim ushloshim chalifos chalifos begadim. If you tell me, I will give you, for solving that riddle, 30 cloths and 30 changes of clothes. That's a lot of, by the way, it's a lot. You know, we're not talking about just going out to Macy's. You know, these are the days where you make the clothes. This is obviously a very high price that he's setting over here for this, and obviously he means one for each of you.
Who's when they saw him? Who's they?
Exactly. Apparently, her friends become his friends, or at least right now. And he says, if you're going to find that. Now, you've pointed out a good point over here, is that umetzasem actually means find in what sense? Metzasem usually means finding, as in when you're searching for an article, you go and find it, rather than I'm trying to understand, right? Which is important because that might relate to his parable, or his riddle. Let's read his riddle, and then we'll come back to that for a moment. His riddle is, what has to see the other side of the bargain in Yud Gimel. Im lo suchlu lagid li, if you're not able to tell me, unesatem atem li shloshim sidim shloshim chalifos begadim vayamru lo chod echidoscha v'nishma ena. He says, if you don't work it out by 7 days, then you will give me 30 of the sidim, pieces of cloth, and 30 changes of clothing, and they accept the riddle. By the way, the odds are stacked in which direction? Who has the most to lose from this wager?
He does.
Why?
He's one person.
Meaning he has to finance 30 garments. Whereas if he were to win, and they were to pay him, each person would only have to pay one. One of those garments or these clothing, which is obviously why they say go ahead, meaning that the odds are stacked in their favor in a very good way. And he says the following: from the food from the one that ate comes out food, and from that which is strong or brazen comes out sweetness. Nobody was able to guess this. What is interesting about this is that usually a riddle is, you know, there's you know, a wolf and a goat and a cabbage, and there's one boat, right? And if you think about it long enough, you're able to. There's two light bulbs, and there's three light bulbs and three switches, and they're in a different room, right? You could go through all the different riddles, but if you think about them long enough, there's a way that you could possibly work it out. Over here, the points out the Malbim, is that no matter how much thinking they're going to do, they're not going to work it out, because what is the answer to this riddle?
The lion.
Right? It's referring to his his it's an experience of his, this carcass which is lying there, bees coming out from the ochel, from the aryeh which ate, and there's machal coming out, and there's the sweetness and from the eyes. Now this is not fair. It's clearly not a fair marshal, right? Which is perhaps comes back to our original point, which is why is he doing this whole thing in the first place? What was he looking for? He's setting up an unfair riddle because he wants to push them. He wants to see how far he can prod them and see what's going to happen over here. Maybe that's part of what he's doing over here, says the Malbim, in the lack of fairness. Now, this comes back to the word umetzasem, right? What's the clue he's giving them? Is how the only way you're going to be able to solve this riddle is if you find it. Find what? Me? You need to understand it. He's pointing out to them, it's not about understanding. It's about finding. Because it's only through experience that I have the answer to this. Interesting enough. So now, this is what the Malbim suggests over here. One more point over here is that how many riddles are there? How many riddles does he ask them?
One.
It seems like one, but there's actually two parts. What are the two parts of his riddle? Just to think very carefully about this. He says the first part is ma'ochel yotzal ma'achal. And as Yotzal Matok, there are really actually two ways. Perhaps they're describing the same thing, but there's two different things. You could guess. There's two layers over here in his mashal. This is important as we continue, just to realize that he's double layering it so that somehow they are going to either trip up on either. Maybe they can guess one, but they won't be able to guess the other. We'll see what he does with that. Dina, what was your thought?
No, what I wanted to say was that now you understand why he couldn't tell his parents anything.
Great. Okay, good. So this comes back to a point over here is that his parents are excluded from this because he doesn't want anybody to do this. Now, was he thinking that originally? When he killed this lion and when he came back and he saw, we don't know. It's hard to know if he knew that. But it certainly plays into the fact that the only person on earth right now who can solve this riddle is Shimshon himself, right? This is the ultimate code. He has the problem with any code, by the way. The problem with the code is that for another person to be able to answer it, they need to have the key to be able to access the code. Right now, Shimshon is the only person who knows the code and the key. There's nobody else who has the key. So now it continues. Now what's happening is that... Pasuk Tezvav. So it's they're reaching the point of 3 days. They're not getting any further because obviously they can't get any further. And he's... In Pasuk Tezvav, Vayhi v'yom ha-shvi'i v'yom lo eshes shimshon patiyas ishtech v'yeged lo eson achida penisrof osof v'es beis ovich bo esh hala yorsheinu krosem lonu haloi. So they turn to her and they say to the wife of Shimshon, you seduce your husband to tell us the riddle, and we'll make you a very fair deal, that if you don't, we won't burn you down. Right? So we'll make it pretty convincing. And we'll include in the bargain your parents' house as well. So we'll make that quite easy to make a choice. Because did he come to inherit us? What's he calling into what are they calling into question? What's the crux of their leverage is? Is loyalty and identity, right? What they're saying to her is ultimately what he wanted to do, which was bring her in, meaning he wanted to kachos ali, right? He wanted to marry her as a Jewess. They're calling out to the other part of her, saying, but remember where you come from, right? Aren't we your friends, brothers, sisters, cousins, right? That's really what they're pulling out of her. And so it's Vatefk Eshes Shimshon Olav, and she cries to him, Vatomer Raksanei Sani, Vulaatani, Achida, Chalata Livnami, Velila, Hegarata. She cries, she says, you hate me, you didn't tell me this, the riddle you tell everybody else, and you don't tell me, don't you trust me? Vayomer Lo, Hine Lo, Vilo, Milo, Hegarati, Velo, Lochagid. Now he uses this so cleverly, he says, my parents, my very flesh and blood, I don't tell. You want me to tell you as well? Meaning, this is not personal. This is about me. So very, 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 very sharp point over here. And by the way, this is so important over here, is that whenever you have a person who's representing something good, or a person who's representing some mission, and there's a love in their life, that love in their life, be it their parents or their wife or the person in the relationship, is always a person under threat, right? Which is perhaps why he protected everybody else in his life by not telling them, okay? But in the end of the day, she keeps going and she says, she cries 7 days, which indicates there must have been, there was a 2 7-day period, because it must have been that she was crying for the second set of days. What's the feast extended for? And he gives in, he tells him, tells her on the last day, and what's the thing she does is she tells them. Right, so she immediately lets the cats out of the bag. In Pasuk Yuches, Vayomer lo anshei ha'ir b'yom ha'shvi'i b'terem yavo acharsa, that people of the city come to him before the sun goes down on the seventh day, and they say, Ma matok midvash, ma az me'ari. What could be sweeter than honey, and what could be stronger than a lion? And so what are they essentially saying? I think, don't you think maybe if we thought about this for a long time? But don't you think that the strongest thing you can think of is a lion, and the sweetest thing you can think of is honey? And I think, you know, like in a very innocent type of way. Vayom Elohim, and he says to them, but by the way, just before we carry on the end of the Pasuk, what did they not say? Now, just to appreciate this. What did they not say?
What was the eater?
Great, you see this? They only answered half of the mashal. You see that? There was two parts. There was me'ochel yotza ma'achal, me'oz yotza matok, right? There were two parts. From the eater leaves the food, and from the the strong leaves the sweet. They only answered half of it, and the Abba suggests that they really had the full message. They got the full lowdown from the wife, but they only presented half of it in a very suggestive fashion because they wanted to pretend that they didn't get it from her, because they wanted to pretend that they weren't in on this whole thing. They really wanted to win this in a gentlemanly fashion. But Shimshon is obviously not very convinced. And he says, if you do not, now he's using a very strange way of saying this, he says, if you do not plow with my calf, you would not have found the riddle. And I think what is being couched over here is obviously an intimate innuendo. He's saying that somebody over here seduced my wife. Right? What he's really saying is that somehow somebody over here got involved and seduced her to use him against them, which is what he suggests. And now look how it plays itself out.
But why can't it just be even literal? If you didn't go out and plow right. the field, you wouldn't have found the.
Oh, you know, you're right. But it sounds personal though. Autumn, you see, because meaning like beglasi with my right, my calf. By the way, that's an endearing term. It's not. This is not chattel. This is. But what he's saying is obviously my closest and my most precious okay. is what you are playing with, and so that could mean. And by the way, what we've seen over here is we haven't seen any affairs that have been hinted to, but we have seen threats. Right, we definitely have seen threats, and they threatened to burn down her house and her family's house, right? Civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip, right? This is the Philistines. But in the end of the day, we did see that threat, and he thinks there's something more afoot as well, which is interesting because in the last pasuk over here we have where in pasuk Yotes and Chof we saw Titzlach Alav Ruach Hashem, the spirit of God takes over him. Vayered Ashkelon, he goes to Ashkelon, which is, of course, as we know today, is just above the Gaza Strip. So that's where the Philistine encampment is, one of their primary cities. Vayach mehem shloshim ish vayikach es chalitzasam. So he kills 30 men and takes off their clothes. Vayitena chalifos lemagidei achidon. He says, here you go. Here are your 30. Here's what I owe you. Vayichar apoy vayal beis aviyu. And his anger burnt and he returned to his father's house. Vatihi eishes shimshon nemerei asher rei aloy. And what happens? And she goes to his friend, which means that ultimately he is vindicated. What really happens? She, within 2 weeks of marriage to him, has obviously got stronger allegiances to her first love, meaning she has obviously had a childhood sweetheart who she had, and that person was the one who was able to impress upon her, relieving that secret, says the Ralbag, and his trust and everything he has done to develop this relationship is obviously gone awry, which is an extremely sad part of this story over here. Now, this is over here is also seems to be quite apparent in the fact that when he makes the accusation in Pasuk Yud Zion, Yud Ches, when he makes the accusation that you must have found a way of getting to my wife in order to find this riddle, what does his wife say? His wife says, nothing. That's why you can't find it, because she doesn't respond. She doesn't say anything. He is expecting her to say something. He is testing her. When she doesn't answer, he realizes that in fact that it is true. Right? When he makes the accusation, he says you are in cahoots, and she doesn't respond. He says to them, you must have done something with my wife, or you there's some sort of something going on over here, and she sits silently by. He realizes that her allegiance isn't steadfastly to him, or she would have gone up and said no, or defended him and said, they forced me to, whatever else it is. She didn't say anything, and her silence over here is ominous. And that's why this anger perhaps is not just at them, but also at her.
Why did she marry him?
So it's interesting. It's not so clear. It's not so clear over here at this point in time what she saw in him over here. He was obviously an extremely strong young man, but what you see over here is something very fascinating, and that is that if you're to ask the bystanders at this point in time, Why was it that Shimshon killed 30 Philistines? What's the answer? The answer would be because. Let's say a regular Philistine, living on the streets of Ashkelon, and they hear that there was this terrible terrorist attack the last night, and this Israelite kills 30 Philistines. Why were those 30 Philistines killed? What would they say? Was it an act of national anger? What was the reason that he killed them? Well, because he was personally affronted, be it because his trust was breached, be it because his relationship was breached, whatever it else is. But the bystander over here is appreciating that the killing over here was as a function of his honor being affronted, which is perhaps coming back to that pasuk at the beginning, ki to'ano hu mevakesh. He's looking for a reason, or he's looking for something to be able to get at them. If he went into Ashkelon before his marriage and he killed 30 Philistines, what would happen? They would search him out and kill him. Right? They are the power of the time. But his way of getting in is it now becomes a very personal, very, very, very personal matter. So the onlooker over here is not going to blame him, not going to blame Israelites, in fact, as a whole. They're going to say, this was a terrible family drama over here. There was a lot of breach of trust, that we would have done the same thing in whichever situation or circumstance. And this becomes the beginning of now the widening gyre of Shimshon's revenge cycles. Okay, this is the first, revenge is going to be our second most important word over here, because up till now the first perek was identified by the word vayered, this descent. The second perek that we're going to continue to next week is going to be identified by the idea of revenge and revenge and revenge. So looking forward to